Yeah, thanks very much for the invitation. I've actually never visited PI before, so it's nice to be here, catch up with friends and colleagues, and also remind me what sad overcast days look like and how snow feels. So now I'm down in Houston, Texas, where it's invariably beautiful and sunny and shiny, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise, unless there's a hurricane or something. But I'm excited to tell you about some recent and ongoing work about probing axion strings with CMB birefringence. I also want to start, since we saw already this a bit from Misha this morning. That was a bit of a blast from the past. It reminded me of when I was giving talks on axion quark nuggets. So he only showed us half of the graphic, the first 50 orders of magnitude or so between fuzzy dark matter and Planck mass relics. But I think the rest of the graphic actually is a story about composite dark stuff that has masses way above the Planck mass and could be primordial black holes or dark quark nuggets. So this was a graphic I would show in a talk called Black Holes and Nuggets and Blobs, Oh My. It has a cleverer title than the talk you're getting today, unfortunately. But I thought I'd mention it also because when Marco invited me to speak, he asked me specifically to talk about some of my recent work on gravitationally produced super heavy dark matter, and then I was very happy to accept his invitation, and then I completely forgot that he asked me that, and then 2 months later he asked for a title and abstract, and I went through my head about what would these people like to hear about. I came up with the cosmic strings story. So you're getting the cosmic strings talk today, but if you want to hear more about making dark matter through its gravitational interactions alone, that's also something I'd be happy to discuss. Unfortunately, I'm only hanging around for a couple of days, so I'll be here today and tomorrow morning, but you can find me in that office down the hall over there. Well, Misha missed the reference to his talk, but anyway, fair enough. Oops, sorry, that's not supposed to happen. So this is not a long story, it's a short and sweet story. And some of you, I think, are already quite familiar with some of this work because you're engaged in this work yourself. I wanted to kind of give a teaser of the results for those of you who are kind of anticipating what I'm going to say, but then of course I'll come back and address the broader audience of people who don't know what the heck's going on. So this is the summary slide of the talk. We're thinking about hyperlight axion-like particles, and we're asking about those particles manifesting themselves in the universe today in the form of cosmic strings. And we're interested in the associated cosmological birefringence that would result from this string network. And in what I'll be telling you about today, we made use of publicly available measurements of anisotropic birefringence from Planck and SBT and various other telescopes to derive constraints on this scenario. Their measurements are compatible with no detection of birefringence, and so I'll tell you about the limits that we obtained. And I think the limits are actually quite interesting in the sense that we're already able to probe order one anomaly coefficients, which is sort of the target you are going for. There have been some claimed detections of isotropic birefringence using CMB data. And I'll talk about how the string network models I have in mind are unable to accommodate these measurements of isotropic birefringence typically. I'll talk about the effect of axion mass on these signals, and in fact, how you might be able to make measurements of the axion mass if it were sufficiently light, which is kind of a unique thing, because if you think about probing very light axion-like particles with astrophysics, say, you wouldn't be able to get measurements of their mass, even if you detected a signal, whereas here you get a measurement of the mass. And in the one very last slide at the end, if there's time, I'll talk about some of the work that we're doing now with machine learning. All right, anyway, as I said, that's the summary. For those of you who are anticipating what I'm going to say, but I don't know why it keeps jumping like that. But let's all get on the same page about what's the question here. So we're thinking about axion-like particles and the way in which they might form cosmic strings. So again, for this audience, I probably don't need to belabor the point about what axions are, why we're excited about them. Suffice it to say, I'm thinking about a class of effective field theories in which there exists the new hypothetical spin zero particle, the axion-like particle, which has a mass ma, and I need it to couple to photons. So this is the whole theory. Sorry, I do not know why it wants to jump ahead like that. Can we not do that, please? Slideshow? No, wait, what? Sorry. Just go. All right. And we want to have it coupled to photons. So that's the whole theory. Reasons why you might be interested in axion-like particles beyond the QCD axion are that they arise generically in theories with compactified extra dimensions, such as string theory. And you know, for example, here's the result of a recent study in which they were classifying different compactifications, Calabi-Yau, based on their Hodge number, and deriving predictions in this parameter space of the axion mass and the axion photon coupling for what you'd expect based on the Hodge number. Sorry, it's very tiny, but what you're supposed to take away from it is that there's a wide array of masses that one might expect and a diverse selection of axion photon couplings as well. So in terms of what I'll be talking about, there's a variety of ways of searching for axion-like particles, and we can characterize different cosmological, terrestrial, and astrophysical probes on this parameter space, where horizontal axis is the axion photon coupling, or the horizontal axis is the axion mass, vertical axis is the axion photon coupling. And the probes that we are accustomed to thinking about from terrestrial searches for axion dark matter are shown here. Can you see the cursor? I guess you can. Astrophysics probes larger axion photon coupling, even extending down to arbitrarily low mass, or for example, decaying axion-like particles producing X-rays lead to astrophysical signatures also at higher mass. Now, this is sort of the current landscape of class of models that we're thinking about, as well as different search strategies. And for this talk, we're going to be thinking about a different chunk of the parameter space. In particular, I'm interested in axion-like particles whose masses fall below the Hubble parameter at recombination. It's around 10 to the minus 30 electron volts, and I'll explain why we're thinking about that. And that puts us way off on the left edge of this plot. But nevertheless, I think it's exciting to explore the cosmological signatures of these hyperlight axion-like particles, as Jun Wu and his collaborators dubbed them. Because of the way in which they can lead to signatures in CMB birefringence. So in particular, I'm going to be thinking about the way in which these axions manifest through their formation of cosmic strings. So here is the Lagrangian for some complex scalar who's got a U1 symmetry. It's got a symmetry breaking potential shown at the bottom. And this slide is supposed to explain to you cosmic strings 101 in the event that you've never heard of them before. So we're thinking about preparing the system at a temperature that's above the symmetry breaking scale of the Higgs field. And thermal effects then restore the scalar to the origin. And as the universe expands, the plasma contained within it cools down. And eventually, when the plasma temperature drops below the mass scale of this Higgs, symmetry breaking occurs through a cosmological phase transition, leading to different regions of space occupying different points in the vacuum manifold, shown down here. So it's possible that throughout all of space, in principle, the field is at the red dot, and then there's no strings. But since different Hubble patches are behaving in a fashion that's uncorrelated with one another during the phase transition, you'd expect all of the vacuum manifold to get populated with different patches in different regions of space occupying different points in the valley. So as a consequence, the theory predicts the presence of topological defects called strings, or these are an example of global strings, axion strings, such that the string is a one-dimensional region of space where you move around it in space and the field goes around the valley in field space. At the location of the string, the field sits at the origin, and there's a large energy density there, which leads to the tension of the string, its mass per unit length, being set by the decay constant. And as we're away from the string, the axion field has some gradient, because you can see that axion field needs to go from red to green or green to blue as we move around the string. In addition to these guys, long strings that perhaps are infinite in extent and cross the entire observable universe, the strings can also turn back on themselves, forming loops. And if you ask what the axion field does in the vicinity of the loop, it's kind of interesting. So if we consider a path here that traverses through the plane of the loop, the axion field would go all the way around the valley in the wine bottle. So we'd go red, green, blue, red, red, green, blue, red, along a path that pokes through the plane of the loop. On the other hand, and the axion field therefore would change by 2 pi FA, where FA is essentially the radius in the field space. On the other hand, if we consider a path that misses the loop, we would go red, green, blue, and we'd kind of change our mind and come back to where we started. I'm going to put this down before I break the cool TV. I'm unaccustomed to the thing being a TV and not just a big screen with a projector. In any case, the axion field then there's no net change in the axion field. We go red, green, blue, we turn around, come back, green, red. This is going to have important consequences when I talk about the associated birefringence signal. So there's a lot of interest in cosmological defect networks for a variety of reasons, and different groups around the world are trying to simulate the dynamics of that phase transition and the resultant dynamics of the wiggly jiggly string network. So there's a handful of groups. I'm showing the results from the Bushman et al. Paper, so Ben Softy's group at Berkeley. This is a video, we'll talk about it in a second. But there's also a group in Japan, Saikawa and company. There's a group, Gorghetto and company. So there's a handful of people doing these cutting edge, really extremely huge field theoretic string simulations. And so let's watch the cool video. So this is some chunk of volume where all the yellow stuff are segments of string. And as the clock goes forward, this guy down here is going to be the clock. We'll watch the string network evolve. And you can see that the strings are doing a kind of beautiful dance in which the curvy segments of string are being bent by their own tension, and this causes them to move and accelerate, and now they act as antennas emitting axions, and as a consequence, a loop of string is able to exhaust its energy by ejecting axions and thereby shrink. So loops are continuously being shrunk by axion emission. In addition, as long strings cross, they reconnect. And in this way, long strings chop up to form new loops, which are continuously decaying by axion emission. And so there's a lot that we've learned about cosmic string networks by performing simulations such as these recently, as well as simulations for many decades. We can see that the network consists of both long strings as well as string loops. As I said, the string tension pulls the bent string segments, assuming that they're smaller than cosmological scale. So a bend that's bigger than the size of the observable universe won't respond to the tension. But if the bend is smaller than the cosmological scale and the different segments of string are in causal contact, then it starts to pull and wiggle. String segments cross and reconnect. And that reconnection forms new loops. And these loops emit axions and thereby collapse. They also emit gravitational wave radiation. They also emit the radial mode of the string-forming field. But the dominant emission channel is into axions. And as a consequence, the distribution over loop lengths tracks Hubble, and the average energy density tracks Hubble. And I'll talk more about that scaling in just a second on the next slide. But there's a lot of things we would still like to know about these string networks. One thing that's a particularly hot topic, but not at all relevant to what I'm going to tell you about, is what's the energy spectrum of axion emission? Because if you're interested in these axion strings producing QCD axion dark matter, it's important to get a handle on what the energy spectrum is of the resultant radiation, because that informs how many axions are in the universe today. It sets the relic abundance of axion dark matter. But I'm thinking about axion-like particles whose masses are far too low for these guys to be a form of axion dark matter, so I'm less interested in what's the energy spectrum of the resultant axion emission. But one thing that I do care about is just how many strings are going to be in the universe today, because I'm going to ask about the cosmological birefringence signature of these strings as I look at the CMB, I look through the string network. And so it's important to get a handle on whether the string network maintains scaling, which we're going to talk about on the next slide, or if there's a deviation from scaling.
What's the fraction of the energy density of those
strings? It's mu FA squared over M Planck squared. So if the string network maintains scaling, then the energy density it contains is parametrically string tension times Hubble squared, where so energy in the strings is mu Hubble squared, and mu is like FA squared with some log, whereas the critical density would be M Planck squared Hubble squared. So if the network is maintaining scaling, meaning this relation holds with a constant C, then the energy fraction is like FA over M Planck quantity squared. So they don't come to dominate, if that's what you're interested in.
You know, I'm asking about radiation of axions, because if there's not a dark matter, there's going to be dark radiation.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, you could calculate the you can calculate the resultant dark radiation and contribution to N effective, but similarly, unless FA were really close to M Planck, since they're carrying not so much energy, and then the axion radiation would redshift down like the plasma, it wouldn't be very large. Yeah, I should say, feel free to stop me at any, obviously, needless to say, feel free to stop me at any point. You can ask anything, except for one plot, which you can't ask about, but we've already passed it. The Hodge numbers plot. Nobody asked anyway.
The number of strings of Hubble volume, is that dependent on the string
section of the copies? Yeah, that's the next slide. So there's a lot of questions. The questions about string networks that are relevant to me have to do with this issue of scaling and non-scaling. So let's talk about that for a minute. In the simulations, they can measure this quantity xc, which is some dimensionless proxy for the amount of strings per volume. So it's measured as the total. If you take some fiducial volume, V, xc is defined as the amount of string, the length of string contained within that volume times t squared. And it's some dimensionless, typically order one number. And it shows up when you calculate the energy density in the string network as a prefactor, like I had on the board there. And so you can think of it as each string contributes to the energy roughly an amount energy density roughly in amount mu Hubble squared, and xc is sort of counting how many strings are in a Hubble volume. And the string network is said to be in scaling if xc is a constant, such that at different times, the network looks statistically equivalent when referenced to the Hubble scale. So the typical string lengths measured in Hubble units are unchanging, and the energy measured in Hubble units are unchanging. That would be in scaling. And one of the big questions that we can ask using these simulations is whether networks are in scaling or not. So scaling would be a constant xc. And here's the results from a couple of the recent simulations, the Bushman et al. One that I showed on the previous slide, in which they've used adaptive mesh refinement, reaching, I think, effectively something like 200,000 lattice sites at the smallest scales, something like that. And here's just for the sake of comparison, another recent simulation by Sakawa et al., which uses a fixed lattice of about 11,000 by 11,000 by 11,000. I'm told that this is a lot. Will, various people seem impressed by that. So I've never done one.
Actually, so can you resolve this, right? Like that this resolution required because you want to have the Hubble volume, but also you want to resolve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's no way you'd be able to simulate a string network today with a cosmological scale loop and nevertheless resolving the string core, which is set by the particle physics length scales. For these simulations, the AMR one ensures that they always get four lattice sites across the string. So you're resolving the string at the sake of you're seeing four points across it. And this one, I think, has more like one lattice site. And a lot of their paper is actually about how do certain aspects of the results vary with the lattice spacing, and you know how they're getting contaminated by those finite difference effects. So the AMR one is doing better at resolving the string, but it's still only at the level of I get four dots across the string core.
Why are they giving you 1/log squared?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, so there's a question about whether they want to have a model that continues to, okay, so let me tell you the story about this plot, and then I'll address Mina's question. So as I said, scaling would be Xi is a constant, but Xi clearly does not look like it's a constant. Here it seems to be growing shallowly. Here they did a bunch of different simulations with different choices of initial conditions. That's why there's so many curves. But they generally trend upward as well. And so then you'd like to know what's the functional form of this growth with time. I should have said the horizontal axis is measuring time. It's the log of the mass of the radial mode compared to the Hubble scale, which is basically the cosmological time in units of the thickness of the string core. And
error bars, so that's like numerical resolution, or it's like some statistical.
On the left, they only did one simulation. So I'm not exactly sure how they extracted the error bars, but there's only one sim. Whereas here they have a whole family of them with different initial conditions. I think even for this one where you see this band, this is statistical now, where they ran multiple simulations at that same initial condition to get the statistical spread. So anyway, the Xi parameter appears to be growing. And you want to know how it's growing. So there's some argument that you'd expect it to be growing as a log. But there's another issue that maybe it would grow like a log for some while and saturate. So I think that's why they modeled it with the 1 over log squared terms, perhaps. At least this Xi sat, which I didn't actually write down on the slide, is a model that grows linearly initially and then saturates to flat. I guess this one would just keep growing linearly because this guy's going to win at late times. So the bottom line is we don't entirely know how many strings to expect in the Hubble volume today because we can't now and never we will never be able to simulate a string network with a dynamic range between today's cosmological scales and some very tiny particle physical length scale. If we were to extrapolate this behavior, today would be roughly at log of the log on the horizontal axis being around 120. That would be the ratio of Hubble today and taking the radial mode mass to be 10 to the 10 GeV, 10 to the 12 GeV, something like that. And so if you were to extrapolate, we would get something like Xi is 25-ish, plus or minus a few. Yeah, using the linear fit. So if you just use the only constant plus a linear, and the constant's kind of irrelevant. The C1 number is about 0.2 or something. So that's how you go from 120 down to 25. The point is, there's going to be some uncertainties in the signal I'll talk about associated with the fact that we don't entirely know how these string networks behave. But nevertheless, it's encouraging to suggest that since there's many more strings in the universe at late times, the signal would be stronger. And so this motivates searching for axion-like particles through the way in which their strings would imprint on the CMB. So as for the more general question of how am I going to search out axion-like particles in nature axion strings, I should say, in nature, there's a variety of ways in which you could look for them. Classic studies of cosmological probes, gravitational probes, in which there's imprints on the CMB from lensing. There could be string wakes that leave some imprint on large-scale structure, or the emission of gravitational waves themselves could potentially be detected across a broad range of frequencies with both ground-based interferometers, space-based interferometers, or pulsar timing. And if one allows for additional non-gravitational interactions, then we can search out these axion strings through possibly the particle emission that they produce, which would contribute to dark radiation, as Mina pointed out, although you'd expect that to be really tiny unless the decay constant were pretty large. Or it could lead to effects on other cosmological observables like nucleosynthesis, or the CMB, or could lead to detectable effects today, such as cosmic rays. What I want to focus on is searching for axion strings using observations of CMB birefringence, which is something that Curley and company pointed out. We're also, I guess, going to hear on Thursday from Winston about their recent work searching for axions using galaxy polarization shapes. Unfortunately, I won't be here for that, but I hope your talk goes well.
Zoom.
I will zoom in. Okay, good. Unless it's during my class. But anyway, this is a graphic from their figure, from their paper. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about birefringence from axion strings, and then I'll tell you about the limits that we get, then I'll tell you about how things change with mass, then we'll talk about non-Gaussianity, and then we'll be done. All right, so how are we going to actually detect these axion strings if they're with us in the universe today? And so I said that I would assume the presence of an axion-photon coupling. So let's allow axions to interact with photons through the standard form of the axion-photon coupling. The axion-photon coupling, I'm going to parameterize it like this, negative fancy A alpha electromagnetic over pi FA, where fancy A is the related to the electromagnetic anomaly coefficient. Fancy A is a dimensionless number, so that's going to be the model parameter from now on. I'm trading it for trading GA gamma gamma for A. And what do you expect A to be? So A may result from having integrated out some heavy particles at the PQ scale, and A then is linked with the PQ charges and electromagnetic charges of those particles. So if you think that the electromagnetic charge might be measured in units of a third, then you'd expect fancy A to be measured in some multiples of a ninth. It gives you a reasonable expectation for how big this coupling ought to be. Notice that the axion photon coupling itself can be really, really big or really, really small because it's dimensionful. As you vary FA, if you lift FA, you make the axion photon coupling smaller and smaller. But the anomaly coefficient, you expect it to be not terribly much smaller than 0.1. So there's some target now that we can hope to probe using these measurements of CMB birefringence. And now the idea is that if we imagine a linearly polarized photon or electromagnetic wave propagating through an inhomogeneous axion field, a phenomenon known as circular birefringence occurs, where the left and right circular polarization modes travel with different speeds. They feel different indices of refraction. And as a consequence, a linearly polarized plane wave has its plane of polarization rotated as it passes through the axion field. And the rotation angle is given by this formula, which I've written as an integral over the gradient of the axion field. You can think of it as the change in the axion field, but since we're going to be wrapping all the way around the valley of the wine bottle, it's better to think of it as the integral of the gradient. Otherwise, you get confused about zeros and two pis and things. If you want to see a nice derivation of this, I'd encourage you to read Michael's paper, or at least the appendix of Michael's paper, which I assume Michael wrote. It's a very nice, clear derivation of why electromagnetic waves propagating through an axion field have this phenomenon occur. But it's an oldish idea. And so now let's think about a photon that's propagating through an axion string network and passes right through the plane of a string loop. And we already talked about how along this path, the axion field wraps the full valley of the wine bottle. So the axion field changes by a full 2 pi FA, plus 2 pi FA or minus 2 pi FA. And using this handy dandy formula, the associated birefringence angle is then the product of the axion photon coupling and some factor FA. But since we parameterize the axion photon coupling to have an FA in the denominator, they cancel out. And we're left to find that the associated birefringence angle is just related to this electromagnetic anomaly coefficient. It's insensitive then to the actual PQ breaking scale. And this was a clever observation that Jun Wu and company made in 2019. So here's a way in which we can search for axion-like particles, search for the coupling to electromagnetism, and not suffer from the fact that the scale of PQ breaking is unknown. Here, we're not going to care what the scale of PQ breaking is at all. We're going straight for the throat and going after the electromagnetic anomaly coefficient. Now, what I want to tell you about is what the CMB sky looks like now when we look at it through the string network. And in order to do that, I need to calculate the imprint of a string network on the CMB. But I'm not doing these simulations of axion string networks. And even if I did, you know, going from the simulations that they've done with their limited dynamic range to the range that would be appropriate for cosmological scales today is tricky. So at this point, we introduce something that I've been calling the loop crossing model, which is a very crude and simplified picture of a cosmic string network that I argue provides a reliable description for the purpose of calculating two-point statistics. And so it works something like this. I'm going to suppose that all of the strings in the network are circles, circular planar loops. And I randomize the orientation of these loops from over the sphere. And I randomize their locations throughout space. And now the idea is that I want to let the size and abundance of the loops change over cosmological time so as to mimic scaling. So at any given time, I'm going to suppose that all the loops in the network have the same size, which is some fixed fraction of the Hubble scale. So zeta naught is a dimensionless number. If it were 1, then I'd be having Hubble scale loops in the network at any time. And if it were 0.1, then the loops in the network are around a tenth of a Hubble scale at a given time. This is not telling me, this formula doesn't tell me how the size of a particular loop evolves. Like a given loop will wiggle and jiggle and shrink. It's just saying if you take snapshots of the network at different times, you're going to find at any given time loops in the network that are about this fraction of the Hubble scale. And similarly, I'm going to allow the number of loops in the network to evolve so as to track Hubble with this XC parameter that we were talking about before, such that the energy density carried by the string network is some XC parameter times string tension times Hubble. So if XC were 1, then there'd be basically one string loop per Hubble volume at a given time. And if XC were 25, there'd be roughly 25 loops per Hubble volume at a given time. So now the theory has been reduced to 4 model parameters, 2 particle physics parameters, MA and the electromagnetic anomaly coefficient, and 2 effective parameters that capture the properties of the string network itself, zeta naught and XC naught. This thing on the right that's been flashing in your face for the last 5 minutes is supposed to be an illustration of how this might work for the parameters in which zeta naught and XC naught are both 1. So this is showing snapshots of the string network on the past light cone, where at the earliest time here, you have tiny loops. And as time goes by, the snapshots tend to have bigger and bigger loops. So what you're supposed to be imagining is that we're shooting photons from the CMB surface of last scattering towards the origin, and they're propagating through these concentric shells of circular planar loops. This graphic doesn't actually illustrate how they're randomized in orientation. It just, we just for the sake of showing a graphic, they're all normal to the surface, but it gives you a sense of what's going on. Make sense? So here's another, the left is another way of illustrating the same sort of thing, but also with some simulation results presented at the bottom. So in this visualization, I'm showing the CMB surface of last scattering, and then this graphic kind of illustrates snapshots of the string network with smaller loops at earlier times, bigger loops at later times. And at the bottom, it's the result of propagating photons through this system, where, and it's showing the associated birefringence angle. So the birefringence is initially at 0. I'm not giving the numbers because it's not terribly important just for the sake of illustration, but birefringence is initially at 0. And as time goes by, smaller loops imprint small scale features on the network, and then later bigger loops imprint bigger features on the network, until when you get down to redshift of 0, you've built up the entire birefringence map from small to bigger angular scales.
So in time, is there any coherence or not, like
an
anti-coherence in this model?
Yeah, there is not. We don't assume any. So to do the simulations, we really do discretize in Z with, I think, 10 or 11 bins or something. And at each time, we refresh totally the string network. So it's not as if there had been a loop here on one of the outer shells earlier times, it's not like I'm more likely to put a loop near the same spot but smaller. It's completely redraw of the whole network. Yeah, it's stable against changing the delta z, but we never tried actually introducing correlations, because I think that the idea being that the delta z is supposed to be sufficiently long, it's more than a Hubble time. It's around a Hubble time. So it's long enough that any Hubble scale structures would have already collapsed and new ones would have formed. So I'm not expecting to, I'm not accounting for the fact, which may be what you're asking about, of, you know, can I watch the loop collapsing with time in my past light cone? Because yeah. The photons only encounter that loop once. So I only need one snapshot of that loop.
What redshifts contribute? So like Neil's point might be relevant for where it takes a whole time for one part of the static to go through the loop, you know, compared to the other.
Yeah. Yeah, the next couple slides I'll have some analytic discussion of how we understand this power spectrum result. And I'll talk a little bit about the connection between angular scales and redshift. So anticipating that, let me just give the punchline, which is that from the simulation of the string network and the accumulation of its birefringence, we derive predictions for the angular power spectrum of the birefringence map, which is found to be roughly scale invariant for multipoles up to about 100, and then it drops off beyond there. And the drop off beyond there is associated with the fact that at the surface of last scattering, there was some loops were already a certain size. So you don't have any smaller scale loops present in the system, so there's not much power at multipoles above L of 100, which is roughly the horizon size at radiation matter equality.
So Ed, if you were to track this through as a loop sort of collapsing, pitching off, isn't that going to create some very high angular scale structure as a loop?
Yeah, that's true. So I mean, the thing, when I refresh the network, I'm just putting down basically the initial loop size. And you're right that each of those loops will collapse to zero. So there will at some point be very small structures in the system. But as the loops are collapsing, they don't spend very long passing through small sizes. So I would expect that they wouldn't have an appreciable impact at high L, but it would boost it a little bit. What'd you say?
Lifetime's proportions, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You might have mentioned it, but what are the typical velocities of these?
Oh, right, thanks. I did forget to mention that. So I put them down at rest.
So if those loops are coming from as far as I understand, they should have
That's true. Yeah, they can come with a kick. So, I mean, if you imagine two long strings crossing to form a loop, it gives the loop some initial velocity, but that's not being included in the model.
It also uses effects on the CMP from ISW, for example. But you're neglecting, lensing.
I mean, there's some orthogonal set of probes that that access the tension of the strings and then are gravitational in nature. So like the Kaiser-Stebbins effect, where you get temperature discontinuities across the string. And those would also apply to these types of models, but they would probe a parameter I didn't care about, which is the FA parameter.
Can I ask one more? Mm-hmm. Do these strings decrease?
I don't expect them to accrete. I mean, there's in principle, there's going to be some wake effect, like other cosmic strings. I haven't calculated that. It would depend on the tension. So, do you want them to accrete?
No, I'm accreting.
All right. Let me talk a little bit. I have two slides to talk a little bit about the analytic results. So in this figure, the solid curve is the output of doing these types of simulations. The band is the spread across many simulations. And you can see how there's more of a spread at low L and less of a spread at high L. And the black dashed is some analytical results. Let me just say a few words about how the analytical results are obtained, because it's probably not, related to Matt's question, but I have some other more interesting stuff to talk about after we're done with this. So, as we've already mentioned a couple times now, if I want the two-point correlation function between the birefringence at different points on the sky, parametrically it's going to go like the contribution from each individual loop, which we said was fancy A times alpha electromagnetic. And now the idea is that there will only be a correlation if these two photons are propagating through the same loops, because if they don't go through the same loops, they don't get correlated. That's illustrated over here, where these smaller loops at earlier times, the photons don't go through them, so they don't contribute to the correlation, and it's the larger loops at late times that cause them to correlate. So now there's some connection between angular scale and redshift. And that's also shown in this graphic, where if I'm interested in a particular angular scale, I can ask at what time did the loops in the network have that typical angular scale? And the birefringence only accumulates from that point onward. If you assume that the birefringence only accumulates from that point onward, you can derive an analytical expression for the correlation function and then the power spectrum. And that's also illustrated here, in which the horizontal axis is this, the opening angle you're interested in, and the vertical axis is the redshift after which birefringence begins to accumulate. So at large angular scales, you only start accumulating birefringence at very low redshift. And as you run the angular scale down, you start accumulating at earlier and earlier redshift until you hit an angular scale of about 10 to the minus 2 radians. And that corresponds to the Hubble scale at the surface of last scattering, roughly. So this is what I said would address Matt's question to some extent. I don't have a graphic here showing, for example, how the power spectrum builds up as you go through the different shells, but it would be something like, you know, getting the power spectrum for each of these maps and watching them build up. So you'd build up the high L stuff at early times and low L stuff at later times. Okay, and maybe I'll skip through this real fast, but just to say that you can derive now correlation functions, both numerically using loop crossing model and analytically, which are the solid and dashed curves respectively. And zeta naught was that effective loop size parameter. So as you dial down zeta naught, the effect is that you get correlations only at smaller angular scales, or in terms of the power spectrum, the peak in the power spectrum migrates towards higher L. But so this is how the string network leads to birefringence. But I can't just point a telescope at a point on the sky and read out the birefringence there. How do I actually get information about cosmological anisotropic birefringence from, say, CMB measurements? And the idea is that you can't make use of polarization at a given point on the sky because we don't know the intrinsic polarization of that photon at the surface of last scattering. Instead, we can make use of statistical information, which is to say that we think the CMB was built only from E modes and had B modes absent. But birefringence twists each of the polarization vectors, so it's precisely converting E mode type polarization into B mode type polarization in a fashion such that the amplitude of the B mode signal is now correlated with the E mode signal. And so one of the ways to search for anisotropic birefringence is to look for correlations between EB or even TB. And this is the way in which each of the various CMB telescopes reports on their measurements of anisotropic birefringence. In this slide, the delta phi is alpha. So it's the same birefringence angle we were talking about before.
How is this map different from if you have fluctuations in the map to the starting fluctuation?
Yeah. Thanks. That's an excellent question. I should have mentioned much earlier. So. One of the things that's important about the string network signal as opposed to axion dark matter is that you can get effects that are large compared to 2 pi FA. Because on the one hand, for a given loop, the effect I get is going to be proportional to 2 pi FA. But if I go through multiple loops with random orientations, I build up birefringence like a random walk. So the net effect is going to be 2 pi FA times root number of loops. Whereas with axion dark matter, I start out with a less than order 2 pi FA, and that's all I've got, right? So you'd expect a bigger signal from the string one.
You also average out, you average out the CMB signal as well, but axion dark matter because the subsequent scattering.
Yeah, so there's some effects from both the field is oscillating here at Earth, and the field was already oscillating at. Yeah, so then the mass would have to be below Hubble at recombination. So it's not dark matter, but it's still some axion dark stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
The correlation of the anisotropy.
Yeah,
you would be able to distinguish them, both through the amplitude effect would be different, as I was describing, and also, here you're really getting these loopy features in the birefringence map, whereas with some axion dark energy or axion dark radiation setup, it would look different. Yeah.
For the usual, dark matter, the axion of dark matter, there's a statement that the birefringence is like a derivative effect, so it's proportional only to the difference in dark matter density. Mm-hmm. you know, the CMB side and on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here you're saying that there will be this random walk effect. So can you say more why, like,
yeah.
You have it and don't have it?
Yeah, the thing is, that's why I made some offhand remark when I presented this formula, but maybe it didn't resonate with people. So, I mean, the effect is really the integral of the gradient of the axion field. So the axion field is a circle. So if I have a path through space along which the axion field moves through the circle many times, I keep accumulating. I shouldn't think of it as the difference of the initial and final axion field, because then if I go back to where I started, I would think that the answer is zero. But in fact, you need to account for this topological structure of the vacuum manifold. So the only difference is that when we do strings, we want to think about making whole circuits around the field space, whereas where you do axion dark matter, we never get very far away from the origin. Yeah, thanks. All right, okay, let me start. Oh, thanks, yeah, that's awesome. Glad that they're so supportive of my talk finishing. But I have more things to say, so let me move along. Here, what did we do over here? Now I'm gonna show you the results that we got for axion strings based on existing CMB data. I'll talk a little bit about projections. I'll talk about axion mass. I'll talk about non-Gaussianity. So here we just read a bunch of papers that provided measurements of anisotropic birefringence, put them together on one nice color-coded plot. You can see Planck makes measurements of anisotropic birefringence at low multipoles. The ground-based stuff makes measurements at high multipoles. Everybody's compatible with zero. Nobody detects anisotropic birefringence, so we get constraints on these string networks. So our constraints are being presented here, where horizontal axis is the product of the fancy A parameter squared and XC naught. There's a degeneracy at the level of the two-point function, so I only access that one parameter. And the vertical axis is zeta naught. It's this dimensionless loop size. And you can see that the data likes to keep the amplitude parameter close to zero, shown by this panel. There's also a degeneracy here where if I set the amplitude to zero, I have no information about zeta. So that's why this band goes up down. And so using data from SBT poll, we obtained the strongest constraint, which was a squared xc naught less than about 4 at 95% confidence. This is partly just because if you look at the SBT poll data in particular, it had some downward fluctuations. And so the distribution is a little bit biased negative. So if you ask about the probability of getting positive values, you get a slightly stronger constraint. But more generally, you know, Planck, you also get a comparable constraint at the level of less than a 10 or so. And then Winston and Liang had a very nice paper few months before our paper that was also presenting results similar to this.
negative
C0. It's just there. We don't actually use that to set the limit. So when setting the limit, we only integrate from zero upward. It's just to show that it's not a physical part of the parameter space. It's just for the data analysis to show that the data kind of would like it if the model allowed that to be negative. But there's no strong preference for a negative value, so it's not as if we're saying that the model needs negative a squared xc naught. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if that came across very clearly.
Would that correspond to like a negative EV or?
You would need to do something that produces a negative, because the let's put it another way. The telescopes are making measurements of the power spectrum. Power spectrum should be positive, but the way in which they provide the measurements allows for negative numbers, right? So they're not actually suggesting that there can be a negative birefringence, just that they wanted to get distributions and show how they're centered around zero. But since the way in which they're actually getting the measurements have to do with extracting correlations between E and B, I guess I don't have a formula on the slide to illustrate it very clearly, but effectively a negative birefringence power would correspond to some. Actually, I'm not sure if I want to say. To get the limit, we only integrate from zero up. And the measurements from other telescopes look something like this. So everybody agrees that in this model, the amplitude of the the amplitude parameter a squared x c naught should be around zero plus or minus a few, except for this guy who I think is polar bear, just has very large uncertainties and has nothing to say. All right, what do we make of this limit? So this is coming back to a remark I made at the beginning about what kinds of parameters you expect to be putting in here. So the electromagnetic anomaly coefficient parameter, you expect it to be some order one number times a ninth, so if we set it to a third. And the XC naught parameter is the one that depends how many loops there are in today in the universe. So if you extrapolate this log deviation from scaling, maybe we put in 30. And for those choices, you'd get, say, a squared XC naught already 3.3, which is basically at the limit, at the same level as where the limit's coming in. So, you know, this is here I'm saying that already the data is good enough to be probing the interesting part of this parameter space. I mean, we'd like to hit the floor in which A is maybe 0.1. And best would be if you could go down as far as XC of 1. But we're already well on the way there, where even for these parameters, we're SPT pole is already probing A squared XC of a few. So I think that's pretty interesting. If you ask what's going to happen in the future, we didn't actually do any projections for these parameters, although we probably should do that. But here, to give you a sense of it, there are some projected sensitivities to anisotropic birefringence from this nice paper by Levon Pogosian from some years ago. So the diagonal lines are showing the expected sensitivity of different CMB telescopes to anisotropic birefringence, where Lightbird and Simons, let's remember where we were at. So I'm talking about the vertical axis in the ballpark of 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 1 for the range of parameters that we're thinking about now. So that's here. So Lightbird is going to do quite well at probing the same part of parameter space I'm already talking about, but Simon, stage 4, Pico, or whoever else is in the future will do dramatically better. And so it would be possible to access anomaly coefficient parameters of order a ninth, and maybe even XC parameters of order one. So I think there's something very much to look forward to, and then these searches for axion string-induced birefringence really need to be a target for the CMB program going forward. All right, let me say some of the interesting stuff. So what about isotropic birefringence? There have been various studies searching for isotropic birefringence in recent years, championed largely by Eiichiro Komatsu, but he's not necessarily on all of these papers, so there's other groups as well, where they report a detection at the level of about 3.5 sigma for a non-zero isotropic birefringence. You get the same rotation angle everywhere across the sky. If you've seen those papers, you'd be familiar with this number of 0.34 degrees, but for whatever reason, in our paper, we were using the monopole rather than the sky average, and they differ by a root 4 pi. So 0.34 degrees for the sky average corresponds to negative 1.2 degrees for the monopole in our normalization. But don't worry too much about the sign or the size. The question is, can we accommodate this with axion strings? The string loops produce either a positive or negative birefringence depending on their orientation, because when the photons go through, you get the plus or minus 2 pi FA. On average, you get a zero. But we don't get that many universes to ensemble average over. We get one universe. And so if we ask what's the distribution over the monopole in the loop crossing model for some set of parameters shown here, you'd expect something at the level of zero on average, plus or minus maybe a half a degree. Whereas the detection, the claimed detection is over here at negative 1.2 degrees. And so you can see that it would be tough to explain this claimed detection of isotropic birefringence using the axion string network. The problem is that I picked these parameters so that they were roughly compatible with the limits I just told you about. I need to, because I'm producing both isotropic and anisotropic birefringence, and I need to not run afoul of the limits from anisotropic birefringence. So when I choose the parameter such as to do that, I can't get enough isotropic birefringence. That's also shown here, where the blue and red curves are the same curves you already saw. They were the preferred parameters from SPT pole and, blue is SPT pole. But you'd like to be out here in orange if you wanted to accommodate the measurement of isotropic birefringence. In other words, you want a much larger amplitude parameter. And having them, you know, accommodating both means that they're in the tail of one another's distributions.
Can I ask a question? If you have a single strip crossing the Hubble scale, it would look like
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so that I think is what these tails are about. So
okay.
If from time to time in the simulation you get one really close by loop in our past, one Hubble time in the past or a couple Hubble times in the past, it would contribute a lot to the isotropic signal. And so that can happen.
No, it's not going to be a loop. It's going to be the strings
that are... Oh, sorry, you were asking about long strings.
The long string. I'm asking about the long strings.
Yeah, the long strings. So... for these, the long strings, sorry, the long strings, so if there were a long string, you'd get equal and opposite birefringence on either side of it.
Yeah, but that means that there is some dipole, it appears some sort of dipole.
Yeah.
You have leakage of the dipole to the monopole. Because it's not going to be perfectly dipole, right? It's not going to be centered half of your field of view.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I hadn't thought about long strings. I mean, with regard to loops, I think this is an excellent question, right? So if I just have a one...
This is going to be a loop, but it's like...
Yeah, it's a really big loop, yeah. So that's related to the next thing I was going to say, which is that, I mean, there was a nice paper by... I will wrap up. There's a nice paper by Fumi Takahashi and... sorry, this is not Fumi, sorry. There's a nice paper by this group, Ferreira and Company, recently, where they were exploring ways out of this issue of not being able to accommodate the isotropic and anisotropic birefringences. So they talk about environmental effects, which I guess is related to Mina's question about maybe there's just some nearby string stuff. I don't remember if they specifically are only, I was only thinking about loops, but I guess you're right. You could also have long strings may do the same thing. Or they talk about some other things. I'm sorry?
There is going to be long strings, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, but I'm not accounting for them. So the way in which I'm accounting for the string network, it's all loops.
But you have loops occasionally whose size is Hubble today, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's why you will have, if you have 30 strings, there's going to be a contribution from that that will not necessarily average to zero. The loops will average to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Every string that connects from outside will give you an offset of that distribution.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. I think you're right.
So the sample variance of those like huge loops should give them some monopole.
No. The loops, they are all inside the Hubble. So I'm not sure. The central value will always be, as you showed, zero.
Well.
But if you have things that are connecting outside your Hubble horizon, at every Hubble time, even today, you have 30 strings. 30 strings inside your Hubble volume that are long, but they're not loops, right? The loops is outside Hubble.
Yeah, I guess, I think I agree with you. I think the way I was thinking about it is let's think of a loop, a small one compared to Hubble, and as we dial it up and up and up and up, it starts to contribute more to the monopole, and eventually if its radius now leaves the Hubble scale, now it's a long string.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm
thinking of this differently. So suppose there's a nearby string and then there's an axiom field value at the location of the Earth, that will contribute to the monopole, right? Because every pixel is the difference between Earth and whatever value is there. So then the question is, if the value at the Earth is somewhat abnormal compared to the PDF of the whole universe, let's say maybe we happen to be close to a nearby string, so that our place in this histogram is somewhere at the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And that would lead to a large monopole, am I right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's looped in with the stuff that they're talking about in this paper, which they characterize as environmental effects or Hubble scale gradients.
But that's
not captured by the loop crossing model.
I think I'm thinking more of the second one. Because So the environmental, I think it's very unlikely that you have 30 strings in the Hubble volume, I mean, what are the chances that one is nearby our galaxy? But I think that, I mean, the Hubble scale, yeah.
Yeah, so these things.
To get a big effect. That I don't know, to mock it as a monocle. That I have no idea.
Is it like.
I
have no idea. I guess that also depends on the mass. The axion mass?
Yeah. Yeah, but the mass, forget about the mass, because when you tell on the mass, then you have to worry about the domain wall, so that's not the domain wall in play.
When you're computing this monopole signal, you take into account the fact that we're only looking at some fraction of the sky with the same measurements, so you can actually make the coverage. You're not averaging over the whole sky.
I'm averaging over the whole sky.
Yeah. Is that going to shift this as well?
You're saying because we mask out the galaxy, or?
Yeah.
I don't know if it would lead to a...
The strength of the loop, because the loop could be in a place where you're not actually observing.
I guess I don't know. I mean, that also, now I have to know more about exactly how they did this analysis, and...
But ACT, for example, I think would be sensitive, because they look at the small part.
And even Planck's
have
stoked over
the
sky.
They have to paint in, right?
It's
the
it's like 0.7 of the stars.
Yeah, okay.
Now. The loop will just specifically exclude the disk.
They look so big.
That's why the Milky Way is
Yeah. All right. Sorry, let me
sorry.
No, it's okay. I mean, these are great questions. I think this was interesting because, I mean, essentially this big chunk of this paper that I'm referring to here was attempting to address how to get around the argument that we were providing, which is that it's difficult to accommodate isotropic and anisotropic, and then they're pointing out the same sorts of things. I think Mina and company are pointing out the same sort of things. I did want to say a little bit about the mass. Is it okay if we go one more minute over?
Yeah, maybe.
I try not to take 5 minutes, guys. Sorry, I know we're already running late, but this is a much faster story, and I'll skip the bit about non-Gaussian unless people care. Let's account for the mass. Up until this point, we've been letting the mass basically be so low that the string network is stable until today. But if you allow the mass to live between Hubble today and Hubble at recombination, then at the time when the Hubble parameter drops below the mass, the strings become bounded together by domain walls. And if the domain wall number is 1, that makes the string wall network collapse. What impact does that have on the associated birefringence? So here I'm showing a birefringence map for a small axion mass that's basically comparable to Hubble today, and we're going to crank up the mass. So as we crank up the mass and I rerun the simulation, you can see the effect on the left that we're losing some of the large angular scale structures, and in the terms of the angular power spectrum, we're suppressing the power at low L. And so the idea is that you would lose because remember that there's a connection between angular scale and redshift at which the birefringence is being set up. So as we lift the mass, we're losing power at large angular scales. And one of the interesting impacts of this is that now you have a strongly scale-dependent power spectrum. And in principle, if we made measurements of this power spectrum, we would not only detect evidence of axion-like particles in nature and the associated axion strings, but we get a measurement of the axion mass. And that's pretty interesting because, I mean, there's ways of probing really light axions as dark radiation through astrophysics. You know, you can emit axions from the cores of stars and make them cool down faster. And even if we had a firm detection of that effect happening, we wouldn't learn anything about the axion mass, except the fact that it's lighter than the core temperature of a star. Whereas here, you'd actually get a number for the axion mass. So this window of masses between Hubble at recombination and Hubble today is kind of special, because in that regime, you could actually detect axion strings and measure the mass. Yeah, so we also talked about that. I wasn't planning to say much about it, but if the domain wall number were bigger than 1 and you dial the tension so as to not cause it to overclose the universe, then you could have a stable domain wall network as well. And I'd expect the birefringence signal to be similar to the original string network because. Oh, I don't remember off the top of my head, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry,
Thanks. Anyway, so the point is that even if you have stable string walls, you'd still accumulate birefringence. You get the root n enhancement, so you get a similar effect. On the other hand, Fumi Takahashi's group has been studying axion domain walls without strings. And I'm not going to say anything about that, and I'm not going to say anything about this because we're over time, but basically you can now search for the effect of the non-Gaussianity. You can ask me about it. You can also ask Liang and Winston about it. They were studying this as well using scattering transform methods. If you want to hear a little bit about machine learning with my student Ray, you can ask me about that afterwards. But otherwise, I'm back to the summary slide that you've already seen, so I don't have anything more to say about it other than thanks for listening.
Since the birefringence signal shows up sort of the area of these loops, doesn't the loop crossing model seem to be, I guess, the most conservative because you're arranging everything into circles with the same distribution of radii of curvature?
Most conservative in the sense that you could be doing better to not have circles?
Right, so your C being, 20 or 30 or something, that has to do with the energy density, so the total length of the
circles, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you arrange these lengths into circles, mm-hmm. that's the smallest area you get. Mm-hmm. So that's the smallest birefringence signal you can detect.
Not necessarily, right? Because, I mean, the thing is, the long string,
If you have, like, one giant string that's, like, kind of curvy everywhere, mm-hmm. isn't that, like...
Well, the same message would be smaller.
Yes. Sorry, got it wrong way around. Yeah. So how does the signal then depend on your choice of the shape?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously haven't explored the geometry of the loops. I mean, one of the things that we'd like to do is try to interface more directly with the output of the string network simulations and try to get a cross-check of whether or not, say, the angular power spectrum that we calculate from the loop crossing model, does it look anything like the angular power spectrum you'd get by actually propagating photons through somebody's string network simulation. What features are common and what features, in what regards they differ? The loop crossing model I would expect to reproduce two-point statistics fairly okay, the power spectrum stuff, but it's gonna start to not handle as well more resolved features like, you know, higher point statistics, yeah.
Say you so according to the loop crossing model, if your length path length is longer, then you have more probability intersecting loops, right? So in principle, meaning that if you have a longer and longer length, then the signal the variance of the signal grows as a square root of that length. But on the other hand, if you really have a uniform universe, then unless, you know, if I'm far away, then if I'm sufficiently far away between the beginning of the path and the ending point of the path, then these two points, as I'm playing independently, just the PDF distribution of the axion field. So uh-huh. From that angle, it seems to me that we shouldn't see this growth.
You shouldn't see the root n growth? I'm sorry, maybe I didn't understand. You're saying you wouldn't see the growth associated with root, the random walking?
About the real universe, but about, like, imagine, you know, you could ask what's the prediction for the variance of the signal if I increase the distance to the last scattering surface.
Uh-huh. So meaning there would be more opportunities to transit through loops,
so
or string stuff.
The crossing model, it seems to me that it keeps increasing just because you have, because the rule is that you say, if I'm here, it's zero. If I'm in the loop, it's one unit.
Yeah.
The variance keeps growing.
Yeah.
The square root of n.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you think about the statement that the signal is just proportional to the difference in the field value here and there,
I would just
say this point and that point is just randomly sampling.
Yeah, but that's not correct, right? It's not, the signal is not proportional to the difference of the field value. It's the integral of the gradient of the field. That's right, because the That's why I was saying earlier in response to somebody's question about it's dangerous to think about it as the difference of the field values, because the field is a circle. The field space is a circle. So, you know, if you go all the way around the circle, are you at the same field value or not? So to get the correct answer, you have to not be at the, you have to not come back to where you started. Yeah. But yeah, maybe I didn't make that clear enough, but yeah. I mean, there's ways of doing it, but I like to think of it as a circle. And then somewhat related is, I mean, what maybe the model you're thinking about is more like the work that Fumi Takahashi and company are doing, where they're thinking about axion domain walls without strings. So in their case, this is their birefringence map, where each point on the sky is either a plus or a minus 2 pi FA, because you can pass through multiple walls, but you're bouncing back and forth between two points in field space. So in their case, you only need to know about the value of the axion field here and the value of the axion field at the associated point on the surface of last scattering. Yeah, they have a setup in which you pick some peculiar, I shouldn't say peculiar, but they pick some initial condition in which, we should talk about that more after, maybe. But
yeah, let's talk after, because yeah.
Yeah, but that's a good question. Yeah. Yeah, apologies for running a bit over.
No, we are asking questions. Mm.
Okay, then, so, we can wrap it up here. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the nice talk.
Thank you.